From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Do we have a winner?
Everybody's saying, oh, you got to wait till tomorrow to figure out who won this debate. Well, I'm going to say it tonight. John Kerry won the debate. Carl Rove.
That's Republican Congressman turned MSNBC talk show host Joe Scarborough cutting through the crap right after Thursday's ultimate example of must-see TV. In the auditorium of the University of Miami in Coral Gables, Florida, moderator PBS's Jim Lehrer laid down the rules.
A green light will come on when 30 seconds remain in any given answer. Yellow at 15, red at 5 seconds. And then flashing red means time's up. There is also a backup buzzer system if needed.
All week long, the two war rooms were hard at work lowering expectations for their respective candidates, sending mixed messages praising the cunning while disparaging the competence of their opponent. Meanwhile, the media were sending mixed messages of their own, working themselves into a lather over the cataclysmic importance of the debate, while huffing and puffing over the terms of engagement negotiated by the candidates that were certain to strangle the proceedings. But the TV pundits went further than that, not just lowering expectations for the debate, but for their own performance as commentators, because, well, they're only human. CNN's Tucker Carlson.
John Kerry obviously thought his appearance was significant enough to get a fake and bake. You know, cosmetics matter. The campaigns understand that. I mean, sure, it's shallow, but so is a lot of life is shallow. And appearance actually does make a difference.
It's a deep point, actually.
It is a deep point.
After the debate, cosmetics were an issue. True, not much was said about the Kerry tan. It seemed to have faded. But the president got thumbs down for blinking, and his opponent an unavoidable thumbs up for height. Fox News' Britt Hume.
There's a thing we have to worry about in television called headroom.
Mm-hmm.
And that is when you're trying to match shots side by side, one of the things you do is you give both parties the same amount of headroom in the shot. Because of Kerry's height within the frame, his picture was necessarily bigger.
Right.
And the result was you had more lectern and less bush, and Kerry's shot the other way around.
Cable's immediate reaction was noteworthy because it didn't shrink from stating the obvious, that Kerry performed better than the president. Usually that verdict, being the whole point of the thing, would not have been rendered so quickly. It's Cable's habit to tug and twist every issue like a sore tooth to keep up the suspense. Not in this case. Even the conservatives from the Weekly Standard, the reliably pro-Bush Fred Barnes and Bill Kristol, had to concede on Fox.
I'll have to say John Kerry did better than I expected. I thought he was very good, very articulate. The one thing, and particularly in raising questions about decisions by President Bush.
Bill Kristol.
Kerry was forceful and articulate, and he said two or three times that the president made a mistake in invading Iraq. That was his core message, but I think he did a pretty good job by his lights of making the case.
And that judgment was backed up by the omnipresent and utterly meaningless measures by which public response is instantly gauged on television. CBS used people meters and some colored bars.
Now, that two reading on the meter you saw there was about as high as anybody got tonight. Now, moments later, after Kerry spoke, when President Bush responded, the meter abruptly dropped, and the average response from our uncommitteds actually briefly went negative. Watch.
Then there were the obligatory visits to the spin room, an exercise in self-conscious manipulation that reporters engage in like apes on a treadmill.
Voted for the war that he now calls a mistake and a diversion.
Karen Hughes, thank you very much. Tom, the fresh spin from the spin room. Back to you.
Even though no one, no reporter, no audience member, not even the spinners themselves, take their remarks as anything other than theater, it's all part of the process.
Let's go now to NBC's Campbell Brown, who's there with Mike McCurry, who served Bill Clinton as press secretary and has joined the Kerry campaign now. Campbell?
The next day, the newspapers offered more style and a little substance, including some fact-checking from the Associated Press, Reuters, The Washington Post, The New York Times, and The L.A. Times. For the most part, though, it was clear, as Eric Umansky noted in Slate, that, quote, if you watch the debate, go for a nice walk, because you largely don't need to read the papers. They have two general genres, transcript-heavy lead stories and studiously nonpartisan palaver, a.k.a. news analysis. In fact, if you really wanted to keep your head clear and sharp, you would have switched off your TV right after the candidates shook hands and left the stage, because the rest is just confusion. And if you stay tuned in, especially this week, you won't remember what happened on Thursday at all. MSNBC's Joe Scarborough.
Karl Rove knows John Kerry won this debate. You followed these campaigns. You followed a lot of campaigns before 2004. What's Karl Rove thinking tonight, and what's he going to do tomorrow morning to launch a counteroffensive?
As early as Friday, Fox News was quoting Kerry as saying some very odd things on the campaign trail, not reported anywhere else and denied by his campaign. Things about manicures and being a metrosexual. But those are what Zell Miller would call spitballs. If you're Karl Rove and you want to control the debate over the debate, you're gonna launch your biggest gun.
We had a great debate last night.
We're joined now by James Fallows, national correspondent for The Atlantic Monthly. Jim, welcome back.
Thank you very much.
When we spoke to you a couple of weeks ago, you described the debating styles of the candidates based on their past performances. True to form, were they?
I would say the debate was about 50% true to form. The John Kerry we saw on stage was pretty much a linear extension of his past debating performances, and he was near the high end of what he's done ever before. The surprise to me was how President Bush performed, because based on everything I'd seen from him in the past, I expected a much stronger performance. When he's been at his best, he's managed to be effectively on message, which is to say he has his two or three main points, but he finds a way to have them seem natural and organic and in context. When he's been weak in off-the-cuff performances, like at press conferences, he has a kind of clumsy version of being on message where he just reels out the couple of points again and again. And that was, I think, more the situation he was in. The other far more startling aspect of the president's performance was all the nonverbal component. The fact that he was sort of hunched down behind the stage, that he permitted himself to look worried or defensive or upset whenever he was being criticized.
How about the performance of Jim Lehrer, the moderator, who had taken a lot of criticism in 2000 for allowing substantial questions to go substantially unanswered? There were hundreds of rules attached to this debate. Do you think he did a good job?
I think he did do a good job. And again, there is a certain limit to how far you can press the interrogation here. I mean, there were a number of issues sort of left open as assertions on one side or the other. You know, how many security troops were actually trained in Iraq and how many nuclear weapons Korea actually had possessed, et cetera. But I thought that Jim Lehrer, within the constraints imposed on him, did a good job. And really the one thing that was mildly questionable is he seemed to give the president more opportunities for the 30-second follow-ups than he did Senator Kerry.
There were also rules set for the cameramen, and reaction shots were explicitly banned, yet there they were. Is the sun setting, do you suspect, on the excessive debate choreography that the campaigns impose?
You know, I'm sure that the next time there's one of these debates, there'll be an even longer agreement than there was this time. It was 32 pages this time. Let's say it'll be 64 the time after that, and 128. I think that simultaneously, the campaigns will try to set rules, and if they have any kind of canniness, we'll know there's some rules that just are not going to be enforceable. The idea that, you know, the viewing public was going to have the camera strictly on the person who was speaking was preposterous. That's why the most surprising aspect of the president's debate preparation was that he was not sort of steeled to maintain a stony face or a positive face, as Senator Kerry was doing when his opponent was speaking.
Senator Kerry was either writing furiously at his lectern or wearing a smile plastered on his face, a respectful one.
He managed to do something that many sort of pre-debate analysts had said he needed to do, paradoxically being both intense and relaxed-seeming. I think he was able, through much of the debate, to have that combination.
The New York Times' Adam Nagorny decided to shun the spin room after the debate and write his piece from his hotel room. Were there signs of a media rebellion?
There is a kind of risk-taking and daring and bravado. If you're a reporter deciding to say, okay, here's what I think happened and here's what I'm going to say based on my own eyes, as opposed to hearing what's going on in the spin room. So I praise Mr. Nagorny all the more for being willing to do that. Mr. Nagorny's brave rebellion might be a sign of the future for the press. TV has a certain amount of time that it has to fill after the debate, and there are all sorts of things that happen, especially on TV, which are purely convention-driven.
Now let's talk for a moment about the non-media, what we at this show like to call the public. In the hours leading up to the debate, the Democratic National Committee Chief Terry McAuliffe called on Kerry's supporters to weigh in on all the network instant polls, and our mailbox, our humble little mailbox, was crammed with hundreds of emails from Kerry supporters. Is this evidence of the spin machine, or is it evidence of rage against it?
I think it probably is both those things. I mean, the Kerry people probably thought, and with some reason, that if these instant polls could have some sign of a Kerry, quote, victory, unquote, which they seemed to do, that even though everyone knew the limits of that kind of poll, it would have some inevitable psychological effect. You could view this as actually a good thing for politics if you wanted. As many of the measures for having some kind of prediction of what's actually going to happen in an election become debauched for one reason or another, instant polls, actual scientific polls because of, you know, cell phones, which are harder to track people down, all sorts of call screening devices, which make people harder to reach, as all those things become fuzzier, there is an element of actual suspense in elections again. It returns to some degree to the judgment of the candidates once again.
So 4 years ago when Al Gore huffed and puffed and made faces through the first debate, by the second time around, his demeanor had changed dramatically. Can we assume that President Bush in the second debate will cut a different figure altogether?
Certainly, since his team has less reason to be happy with his performance than the Kerry team does, since George Bush has done better in all his previous debates than he did in this most recent one, he's the one from whom one would expect a change. The danger here, of course, is getting into the Al Gore syndrome from 2000, where in the first debate, Al Gore seemed far too aggressive. In the second debate, he was sort of far too passive. And then in the third debate, he had a quite effective combination. So the ideal for President Bush would be to go into the second debate with a kind of confident easiness he's shown in his recent stump appearances and in his past debates, but without seeming too radically different from the George Bushes we've seen before. So that's, I imagine, the tuning that's going on in the Bush camp now.
Jim, thank you very much for your pre-debate thoughts and for your post-debate ones as well. I think we now have closure.
My pleasure. Thank you very much.
James Fallows is national correspondent for The Atlantic Monthly.
Coming up, how the Afghan media is covering its presidential campaign, and a chill runs down the spine of CBS News.
This is On the Media from NPR. This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Upcoming elections are the big story in the U.S., in Iraq, and in Afghanistan. Each country faces a different set of dangers. In the U.S., it's the specter of hanging chads, queasiness over voting electronically for the first time, and a campaign marked by mudslinging. In Iraq, it is fear of proceeding with a partial election because a real election seems less and less likely amid the violence. And in Afghanistan, where elections are slated for October 9th, the danger appears to be that the Taliban will take extreme measures to thwart the process, despite, as President Bush reminds us, the exciting prospect of approximately 10 million registered voters. Pamela Constable is the author of Fragments of Grace, My Search for Meaning in the Strife of South Asia. She's reported for years from Afghanistan for The Washington Post. Pam, welcome back.
Thank you very much.
Where do ordinary people get most of their information in Afghanistan?
That's a very good question. Unfortunately, the answer is they don't. Radio probably is the most important medium in a country like Afghanistan, with very high rates of illiteracy and very few newspapers and very difficult transportation. But, you know, many, many people are very badly informed about everything, including what's happening in their own country. There are many people in Afghanistan who don't even know there's going to be an election.
What passes for media coverage of the election and the candidates there, then?
Yeah, it's so bizarre. I mean, there really is not any election campaign going on here. It's almost hard to describe. If you can imagine, you know, a typical sort of American or Western election with candidates giving speeches and debates and going on TV or radio and talking and having slogans and platforms and supporters and cheers, there's absolutely none of that. I remember thinking 2 weeks ago, oh my God, you know, there's 18 candidates in 34 provinces. What am I going to do? Well, as it turned out so far, I was more than adequate to do the job. This is an eerily silent campaign. People are afraid to have public rallies or events, or they can't afford it. very little traveling by the candidates, very little of anything we would consider essential to holding an election in terms of the recognition of the candidates.
How can they even know about the 17 candidates and who they should select?
They don't. There have been posters printed of each candidate with assistance from the United Nations, and those are everywhere. Everywhere you go, even in small villages, you do see posters. So that's something. There's a huge list of problems. Lack of information is certainly one of them. There's the problem of lack of polling monitors. There's going to be the problem of getting ballots and ballot boxes to the voters and then from the voters and the polls to the places where they're going to be counted. I don't really know how you could get more information to people. It's such a, it's a country with, you know, many, many rural isolated areas. It's going to be an amazing miracle, actually, if the election happens at all.
We have been told by the Bush administration that about 10 million people have registered to vote. Skeptics say there aren't that many people in the country. So can we even reliably know what the population of that nation is?
No, we don't. There has not been a census in a very long time. There is no reliable estimate of the population. It was estimated that there would be approximately 10 million people of voting age in the country. And as you said, all of those and more appear to have registered. I'd be careful, though, not to necessarily call it fraud in the classic sense of the word. In many cases, people did not understand what the registration was for. Many people, especially women who are illiterate and don't know anything about politics in many cases, thought they were getting a food ration card. Therefore, if they had the chance to sign up twice, they would do it.
Is there any sense in the media there, Pam, that these elections are being rushed in order to suit the election cycle here in the United States?
It's a comment that one hears all the time from everyone, that the whole reason this election is being held and held now is to make the United States happy and to provide a foreign policy success for the Bush administration. The American officials here, of course, say that that's not true, that they simply want, you know, the best possible outcome. You know, I think there's a case to be made both ways. It is clearly true that a successful Afghan election would help the Bush administration's image. But I think that this election probably would have happened anyway. You know, what's amazing to me is that most Afghans still want to vote at all. They may not understand the election. They may be poorly prepared for it. They might even not know who the candidates are. But there's a very strong feeling in this country that it's an opportunity to choose their own leaders. I think almost all Afghans understand that, and they want to take part in that no matter what.
All right. Pam, thanks very much.
You're very welcome.
Pamela Constable covers Afghanistan for The Washington Post. Her latest book is Fragments of Grace, My Search for Meaning in the Strife of South Asia.
The Bush administration is touting the upcoming election in Afghanistan as proof that it has defeated the Taliban and put the nation on the course to democracy. But warlords control much of the country and violence still reigns. In the midst of all the uncertainty, how stands the keystone of democracy, a free and unfettered press? For decades, the vast majority of Afghan citizens have relied on radio for their news. OTM's Miranda Kennedy went to Kabul to look into what kind of news they're listening to.
In the newsroom of the Institute for War and Peace Reporting, dozens of Afghan journalists are working to meet their day's deadlines. IWPR is one of several media organizations giving training to local journalists in Afghanistan, and they've just set up Afghanistan's first independent news agency. Right now, the IWPR material is being distributed in true Afghan style. In some places, stories are photocopied and transported to newsrooms by motorbike. But the biggest challenge has been giving Afghans basic skills and trying to purge them of the culture of censorship. Lisa Snellinger is the Institute's coordinator in Afghanistan.
The organization was used to working in countries where people at least had a basic education, I mean a decent basic education. When we came here, reporters not only needed basic reporting skills, they didn't have good general knowledge, even about their own country. They didn't have good language skills. All of this, of course, is obviously the result of disrupted education, disrupted lives.
These cultural difficulties are amplified for Afghan women, but despite that, half of IWPR's trainees are women now. Similar advances can be seen at Radio Arman, Kabul's most popular commercial radio station. Radio Arman was established as a completely apolitical commercial venture, say the three Afghan-Australian brothers who founded it a year ago. But even simple things become political acts in post-Taliban Afghanistan, and Radio Arman often breaks new ground. One Arman call-in talk show gives love advice to Kabul's teenagers. Kabul's conservative clerics are outraged with that program. But it's just one in a long line of controversies, says Zaid Mosini, one of Radio Arman's founders.
When we first started, we had some substantial criticism from certain conservative quarters about the fact that, one, we had women on the air. When people sort of got used to that idea, then there was criticism about the fact that women were interacting with the men on the show. Like, they weren't just coming on, reading the news and disappearing. They were actually having a conversation with a man. And then when they overcame that, there was complaints about the fact that women were laughing on the air. At one point, a newspaper had a cartoon of two people in bed, and underneath it had Arman FM DJs.
Radio Arman is probably Afghanistan's biggest media success story. It's taken the Western Top 40 format and molded it to Afghan tastes. Arman FM ba ahanghay dilpazir Hindi. Arman plays its own unique mix of Afghan, Bollywood, and Western music. Its weekly top 40 charts often feature J-Lo and Ricky Martin, along with the Afghan and Indian artists. Radio Arman has clearly struck a chord with Kabul residents. For a promotional contest to mark its first anniversary, Arman received a colossal 30,000 entries in 36 hours, which may be a world record. But that's not a surprise to Masood Sanjar, Radio Arman's hottest DJ.
That's because for 5 years, people had nothing. There was no music, there was nothing. It's like if you give a thirsty person a glass of water, and it looks like that to me. It is a revolution.
Masood should know about revolution. He was a newsreader for the Taliban's official radio service until they were swept from power in December 2001.
You can't compare 2 years ago with now. It's totally different. Now you have a voice, you can say. For example, under the Taliban, the radio was too strict. Now I'm doing the 6 to 9 breakfast show in Arman FM. I'm chatting, I'm joking, I'm laughing with no restriction of the words.
It seems that even conservative Kabulites have recognized by now that Radio Arman is here to stay. But as Arman begins to expand nationwide, they expect to encounter fresh problems in other cities. There's no doubt in anyone's mind that press freedoms have dramatically improved since the fall of the Taliban. Afghanistan now has a law protecting independent media for the first time. But a recent report by the New York-based Committee to Protect Journalists found that Afghanistan's fledgling democracy still presents many obstacles to a free media. Local journalists continue to be pressured by Islamic conservatives and threatened by government officials, warlords, and armed militias. Many editors and publishers rely on funds from political parties or warlords, and that clearly takes a toll on their ability to be impartial. Out in Afghanistan's remote and lawless provinces, journalists who aren't on the payroll of a warlord or who criticize his regime often feel all kinds of pressures.
Sometimes these pressures are in the form of letters of threat to close down their offices. Sometimes unknown men in the military uniform come to their offices and threaten them to close down.
Waheed Warasta heads the Open Media Fund for Afghanistan, which was founded shortly after the fall of the Taliban to support independent publications. Warasta cites several examples of journalists being intimidated and run out of town for criticizing a local leader. In one recent case, a reporter for Radio Free Europe, which is funded by the U.S. government, was forced to leave the western city of Herat by the powerful local warlord, Ismail Khan.
He was first humiliated verbally by Ismail Khan when he asked some clever questions in front of others, and then was physically beaten, then warned to evacuate Herat. Ismail Khan was describing these free journalists as the slaves of the West.
But Wahid believes that it's the duty of Afghan journalists to struggle against such forces.
Journalists have to sacrifice, in my opinion. They have to be brave. They have to go forward. They might even lose their life, but they should open the way for others. Otherwise, being coward and being cautious will not solve the problem. This is a life fight, I should say, that we should carry.
With Afghanistan's first ever full-fledged democratic elections fast approaching, that fight couldn't be more essential. For On the Media, I'm Miranda Kennedy in Kabul.
You probably know that CBS News was burned by a bogus document about the president's National Guard service. You may not know that when that story was rushed to air on 60 Minutes, it bumped another more important piece that happened to be about forged documents. That story pertains to the president's claim that Iraq had tried to buy yellowcake uranium from the African country of Niger, proof the administration suggested that the danger was imminent and we had to go to war. But 60 Minutes found that the White House had based its claim on forged documents, documents that could easily have been checked. Maybe the irony of it all, that CBS in its National Guard story itself was careless about verifying dubious documents, was too much for the network to take. CBS has decided to spike the Niger report until after the election, a decision that has reportedly infuriated 60 Minutes producers. Newsweek magazine's Mark Hosenball wrote about the chilling effect of Rathergate, and he joins me now. Mark, welcome to On the Media.
Thank you.
So, Mark, a CBS story about Bush's reliance on fake documents to support the war in Iraq is being spiked, at least temporarily, because of another unrelated CBS story that, it turns out, apparently also relied on fake documents. Now, I'm trying to see this from the network's perspective. Under the circumstances, who are we to cast stones? Is that what's going on here?
Yes, it's pretty clear that the network's been completely freaked out by the reaction to and their apparent mishandling of the story based on apparently fake documents about Bush's National Guard service. So they're not going to take any chances with other stories that even appear to look like that story. And so they've decided to hold, not necessarily permanently kill, but hold this other story about how documents came to be circulated alleging that Saddam Hussein's regime had tried to buy uranium in the African country of Niger before the Iraq war, an allegation which made it into President Bush's 2003 State of the Union speech right before the war, and an allegation which later turned out to be partially founded on documents that were obvious fakes.
Let me ask you this. Is there any evidence that the substance of the story that CBS is spiking is under any serious question, that journalistically there's a reason not to run it?
There are certainly still questions that I think are unresolved by the story as to where these documents originated. But I think the story, from what I gather, is based on solid, you know, walking the streets, foot leather reporting, legitimate interviews. The story is up front that it's about phony documents. It doesn't rely on phony documents to make its case.
If you've reported a story and you've documented it and you feel comfortable with it and it's important and it could have a bearing on a very important election and you don't run it, what the hell good are you?
Arguably, you are abdicating your responsibility as a news organization if you don't run a story that's nailed down. I agree with you there.
Does this suggest that the chilling effect of the Rathergate debacle is going to keep CBS from doing its journalistic job indefinitely? Or have they suggested that, you know, at some point in the near future that they're going to get back to doing what journalistic organizations do, which is to commit journalism?
I think it could actually have a long-lasting and deleterious effect on their journalism. Clearly, at the very least, this effect is going to continue until the resolution of their own internal investigation into what happened. If they come up with a clear storyline explaining how they made this mistake with the Bush National Guard documents and find clear victims or culprits who committed that, then maybe they can just sort of say, it was just a bunch of people and we've dealt with them and we're going to get back to good journalism. On the other hand, I think they're still going to be kind of nervous about doing stuff like that. And at least for a while, maybe they ought to be. Maybe they ought to put in a new system in place there first to make sure that these mistakes can't happen again. And I'm sure that's one of the things that they're going to look at.
Could this have worked out any better for the Bush-Cheney campaign?
The CBS miscue with the Bush National Guard documents basically took the National Guard issue about Bush's National Guard service and whether he did it the way he was supposed to do it completely off the table, wrote it out of the script for the rest of the election, made it impossible for anybody, including the Democrats, never mind news organizations, to raise serious questions about it anymore. And that clearly helped the Bush campaign, sure. And this other story is just collateral damage, as they say in the military.
Mark, thanks very much.
Well, thank you for having me.
Mark Hosenball is a reporter with Newsweek. He collaborated with colleague Michael Isikoff on a story of the chilling effect of Rathergate on CBS News.
Coming up, we check in on the effort to create a liberal Limbaugh. Air America is 6 months old. Also, Japan's disturbingly undemocratic press.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for NPR comes from this and other NPR member stations and the Kresge Foundation, building the capacity of nonprofit organizations through challenge grants since 1924, on the web at kresge.org. The Kellogg Foundation, helping people help themselves by investing in individuals, their families, and their communities, on the web at www.wkkf.org. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, making grants to improve the health and healthcare of all Americans, on the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Japan has the world's second largest economy and a flourishing democracy, thanks in part to the post-war help of the United States. But one thing this democracy lacks, according to a new book, is a responsible press. In fact, it's worse than that. Adam Gamble and Takasato Watanabe offered a detailed account in A Public Betrayed, an inside look at Japanese media atrocities and their warnings to the West. They describe a two-tiered system. First, there are Japan's newspapers, read by everyone, but dull as dishwater, offering little but government-approved press releases. And then there are the weeklies, called the Shukanshi, also widely read, with screaming headlines reproduced in subways and on billboards. The Shukanshi offer shocking exposés, some true, some false, along with naked pictures and outrageous smears. The newspapers provide no nourishment, while the Shukanshi feed the nation on a rich diet of lies about its own citizens, its own government, and even its own history. Adam Gamble and Takasato Watanabe, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Brooke.
Thank you.
It's all very peculiar because, as you note, in Japan, newspapers are widely read. In fact, the leading newspaper has as many readers as, what, our top 10 American newspapers combined? And yet you say the Japanese daily papers are almost stultifyingly boring. What is it in the system that creates a newspaper that is both boring yet widely read?
I think there are two reasons. The first one is, you see, 97% of all the newspapers of Japan are home-delivered and monthly subscribed. As the custom of daily practice of the people, they are reading the newspapers. Second one is mostly the political and economic issues are given the information through Kisha Club, so-called press club.
So the two points you mention are they don't really have to compete day to day because virtually everybody who reads the paper subscribes to it. And secondly, the journalists all have to belong to this press club, which, as you describe in your book, is kind of embedding in extremis. How do these press clubs work?
These are information delivery institutions is what they amount to, where if I'm a reporter for, let's say, Asahi Shimbun, and I'm covering the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, rather than go to work each day at Asahi Shimbun building, I go to work each day at the press club within the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, directly physically next to the PR department of the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, being spoon-fed press releases, press conferences, and other information directly to them. really interesting little anecdote. I asked a journalist at the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, what do you do to double-check your sources if a minister gives you information, say, on North Korea? And he said, well, if one minister gives me information, sometimes I will go to a sub-minister to double-check that fact.
You also cite some gentlemen's rules of the press club that struck me as a journalist as pretty hilarious. I mean, they're really not allowed to scoop each other, are they?
That's right. It's bizarre. And you almost think this can't be true, but journalists keep tabs on each other. If I were to put a subject up on the board as the head of my press club saying, we are not going to write about this issue at North Korea, then no one in my club would be allowed to write about that. And if they were to write about it, they would be removed from the club, thereby no longer being able to do their job and cover the Ministry of Foreign Affairs there.
They are company workers before they are journalists. Once they are hired, they are given the possibility to work until the retirement so that they want to keep their position stable and they don't want to have the serious investigative reporting. In addition, you see, there are not so many freelance writers and speakers in Japan so that they are not given the chance to scoop real important matters of the society.
So you have the newspapers who really don't care what's on the front page because it's all subscription, and you have the shukanshi, which absolutely rely on a day-to-day grab. They're a little like tabloids, they're a little like literary magazines, they're a little like porn magazines, and sometimes one magazine can be a combination of all of them. But you point out in your book that the truest truth can appear alongside the most outrageous lie, and there's no attempt within a single magazine to distinguish between truth and lies.
That's absolutely right, Brooke. Oftentimes, it will be perfectly happy to run really superb investigative journalism that cannot appear in the daily press because that stuff can sell. However, just as easily, it will sell pornographic cartoons, chess games, and golf advice, etc. Really fascinating publications, the Shukanshi.
So what are the sorts of absolute falsehoods that you'll find sitting beside the real news in these weekly newspapers?
The case studies that we looked at include a Holocaust denial that ran in a major magazine and then was advertised nationally. We look at the smearing of a Buddhist leader who has been standing up for democracy in his country for many years. We also look at two case studies dealing with World War II war crimes, the Nanjing massacre, where 300,000 people were murdered in a short space of time, as well as the denial in the weekly news magazines of the existence of World War II sex slaves, or so-called comfort women.
You point out in your book that the Japanese killed far more Asians than the Nazis killed Europeans. And yet you say that the newspapers, particularly the weekly newspapers, continue to leave certain stories, like those of the Korean comfort women, untold.
You know, Brooke, the power establishment in Japan is not that different than the power establishment previous to World War II and during World War II. Occupation did make a number of significant changes in various parts of the country, but essentially you're seeing a very continuous stream of power and stream of thought. There's a really strong movement in Japan to keep the realities of World War II and of the Japanese militarists squashed so that the average everyday person doesn't realize what its government did during that war. If you interview even well-established Japanese journalists and talk to them about issues such as the Nanjing massacre or the enslavement of 200,000 comfort women by the Japanese military, many of them will say point blank to you, well, you know, these issues are up for historical debate. They haven't been completely established. And this is not dissimilar than if you were to go to Germany today and talk to educated Germans and have them tell you, you know, the issue about whether or not the Holocaust occurred is still up for debate. That wouldn't happen, yet it is going on in Japan today. And one of the key reasons that this is going on is because of a media that is complicit with the established powers. Professor Watanabe often calls it historical amnesia.
Most of the youngsters, you see, who are not given those information want to forget the things which our ancestors, our fathers and grandfathers have done.
One thing that seems to sell in the media, especially in the Shukanshi weeklies, is anti-Semitism. And that despite the fact that there are virtually no Jews in Japan.
the idea of the Jew in Japan is, first of all, oftentimes it plays as a stand-in for the West. So if a magazine or a writer does not want to directly attack Americans or the West, they will instead use Jews as a term and sort of use that to cover their tracks, so to speak. And the other part about it that's so interesting, I think, to Japanese people is the idea of a conspiracy theory.
Yes. Jewish people, we don't have so many in Japan. So that, you see, when we have the economic failure, like the 1992, our economy drew back from the prosperity so fast. And it was said that this was caused by Jewish economic, you see, conspiracy.
How does the United States figure into all of this? I mean, after all, Japan was defeated, occupied, and supposedly rebuilt in America's democratic image. Why doesn't the media reflect the American model, or does it reflect the American model, and we can't see our own media for what it is?
You know, leading up to World War II, the Japanese militarists were very specific in their plans to consolidate their news industry, putting out literally thousands of newspapers and thousands of magazines out of business, so that by the time they went into World War II, you had just six companies dominating the entire national news media. After the war, when the occupying forces moved in, they did not disassemble this essential infrastructure, so that today you still have six major companies dominating the Japanese news media. And one thing which is unfortunately not as widely known as it should be is that the U.S. CIA put in millions of dollars to the Liberal Democratic Party through the 1950s and 1960s to keep them in power and to keep them following U.S. foreign policy vis-a-vis the Cold War against Russia as well as against China. So the U.S. has done a lot not to disassemble the fundamental aspects of the Japanese news media that existed pre-World War II and which was formed by the Japanese militarists in an attempt to control their population's flow of information.
Yes, and we have the globalization process of economy and politics and everything, but we don't have any concrete idea for the globalization of the public's voice, people's voice. This is the reason why, you see, we wrote this book.
Well, thank you both very much, Takasato Watanabe and Adam Gamble. Thank you very much for coming.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
They are the authors of A Public Betrayed, an inside look at Japanese media atrocities and their warnings to the West.
Six months ago, on March 31st, 2004, Air America began.
Broadcasting from an underground bunker 3,500 feet below Dick Cheney's bunker, Air America Radio is on the air. I'm Al Franken, and welcome to the O. Franken Factor. Today is both an ending...
But Air America was never just one show hosted by Al Franken. It was and remains an entire network, with new show after new show bound together by the common goal of ousting the president from the White House and the common belief that there should be loud and raucous liberal talk radio, just the way there is loud and rowdy conservative talk radio. Here's what that sounded like lately, in case you haven't heard.
Question remains, do the Democrats have what it takes to win against the filthy, disgusting politics of Karl Rove?
It kills me. They go, yeah, but you're a Democrat, right? Or, yeah, but you're liberal. That doesn't change historical fact.
And I've challenged
the
Bill
O'Reilly.
The
Great American Boloff.
Yeah, is that what it's called?
Yeah.
It's a good thing, and I've challenged Bill O'Reilly to a match, and he won't do it. He's bawk, 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 bawk.
Is the Bush family now... For all intents and purposes, are they now the Saudi royal family? Are they now a monarchy? Do they really think they're that special?
Paula Spann surveyed Air America for the Washington Post magazine, and she joins me now. Paula, welcome to OTM.
Thanks, Bob.
6 months ago, when the station was going on the air, Chuck D, co-host of the show Unfiltered, told us that at first they'd be reaching the converted and curious. They began on 16 stations. Have they gone beyond the converted, at least? What's the latest tally?
They began on 16 and they lost two of the biggest, Los Angeles and Chicago, in a contract dispute. Now they're on 33 stations, including two satellite stations, and they're in San Francisco, San Diego, Denver, Atlanta, Philadelphia. This week they added San Francisco. Next week they're adding Boston. So they're getting there.
Evidently they know something about the audience in New York. Can you tell me about it?
New York, actually, it's drawing an audience that looks a lot like an NPR station. It's an affluent, educated audience, more female than talk radio usually draws. In this case, in New York, it was about 50-50 male and female. About a third of the audience was Republican or independent, and it was younger than most talk radio stations can pull, so they were excited about that. And it did fairly well in the ratings, too.
Excited because it expands the political base for liberal voters, or excited because advertisers so covet the youth audience?
Well, exactly. Remember that it wants to make money, and when it can pull affluent, educated listeners who are 25 to 54, that's what advertisers wanted to see. And as the months went on, you could listen and hear advertising for pretty big blue-chip national advertisers, American Express, Ford, Sears, Home Depot. Originally, there were a lot of public service announcements for fighting forest fires, not anymore.
Yeah, it's quite a stark contrast to the early days when the network, it looked like, might not survive the first month or two. Tell me about the fiscal fiasco that ensued.
Early on, Air America felt very confident that it had enough money to weather several years of losses. Its ad reps were told that even if they didn't sell a single spot to a single advertiser, they would be fine for a couple of years. Then suddenly in late April, only a month after they'd gone on the air, a few paychecks bounced. And then in May, it was announced that they couldn't meet the payroll. There was a series of resignations and firings, and things looked grim. For a couple of weeks, people didn't know if they were going to be on the air the next day or not. They got some new investors, they reorganized, things have stabilized. And part of what kept them going, I think, virtually none of the staff left, even though they were afraid of not getting paid. No one could stand to think about what Rush Limbaugh and Sean Hannity would say if the much ballyhooed liberal radio network went kaput after a month.
When Air America debuted, most of the attention was on Janine Garofalo, and especially, I think, Al Franken. Your story in the Post magazine focused on Randy Rhodes, who had been a host of a local talk show in Florida.
She was almost the only person in the whole Air America lineup that had any background at all in commercial talk radio. Her show in West Palm Beach, Florida, consistently beat Rush Limbaugh for the past 5 years. So she had a track record, but she didn't have a high public profile. So for the first couple of months, people didn't pay that much attention to her, but she's getting ratings in the places where there are ratings to be gotten.
From the very beginning, the discussion about Air America was the search for the Limbaugh of the left. Has Air America found that person? Is it Randy Rhodes? Is it Al Franken? Who is it?
I don't know if there could be another Limbaugh, left or right, because he came along at a time when no one else was doing this kind of radio. And he's on 600-plus stations. He almost can't grow into any more markets without competing with himself. But people will certainly be able to have a future in talk radio. Franken is doing very well and probably can if he wants to. Of course, he does a lot of other things, and he's talking about a Senate race in Minnesota. How many of these folks want to go on after the next year or two is unclear to me. Randy Rhodes probably will. She's a radio person before. Like Limbaugh, she trained herself in a lot of small markets. And like Limbaugh, she works alone, no co-hosts. It's basically all Randy all the time.
So apparently, the only people who can't get near the president is the press. Me. We're not permitted to answer or ask questions, or we're not permitted to get near the president. This is amazing. This is sick.
If there is a liberal Limbaugh, maybe it's Randy.
Okay, well, Paula, thanks very much.
You're very welcome. Good to talk to you.
Paula Spann is a staff writer at the Washington Post. She also teaches at the Columbia Graduate School of Journalism. That's it for this week's show. On the Media was directed by Katya Rogers and produced by Megan Ryan, Tony Field, and Mike Volo, and edited
by Brooke. Dylan Keefe is our technical director and Jennifer Munson, our engineer. We had help from Ann Kosseff. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Arun Roth is our senior producer and Dean Capello our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and get free transcripts and MP3 downloads at onthemedia.org and email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. This is On the Media from NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the William T. Grant Foundation, helping the nation value young people as a resource through research and programs, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. The Charles Stewart Mott Foundation, online at mott.org, supporting efforts to promote a just, equitable and sustainable society, and the National Endowment for the Arts. Support from the media comes from the Bydell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the John and Anna Maria Phillips Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
Since WNYC's first broadcast in 1924, we've been dedicated to creating the kind of content we know the world needs. Since then, New York Public Radio's rigorous journalism has gone on to win a Peabody Award and a DuPont Columbia Award, among others. In addition to this award-winning reporting, your sponsorship also supports inspiring storytelling and extraordinary music that is free and accessible to all. To get in touch and find out more, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.